Sometime in midweek, I frankly lost track of the Kissinger shuttle between Aswan and Jerusalem. But by Friday, the secretary was able to announce that Israel and Egypt would jointly sign a ceasefire, which provided for the withdrawal of Israeli forces to the east of the famous Sinai passes, for the withdrawal of Egyptian cannon and missiles west of the Suez Canal, for a thinning out of both Israeli and Egyptian forces in the Sinai, and for the introduction of peacekeeping forces between the two armies. A meaningful ceasefire was to be effected. Now, though the Geneva Conference was in theory a call by both of the superpowers, the USSR and the USSA, it was obvious that this particular offshoot of the Geneva meetings was the achievement of Secretary Kissinger. The Soviet Union did not even announce on Friday the signing of the ceasefire. Pravda contented itself with publishing its now daily damnation of Israel as an imperial warmongering state. You can put in whatever terms you wish. Secretary had, according to our public press, pulled off another one of his miracles. For the first time in 25 years, Egypt and Israel, the Arabs and the Jews, had managed to sit down and work out some kind of meaningful agreement. But I wonder how much of a miracle it was. Secretary Kissinger is not a man who is careless of his good name. Part of his effectiveness comes from his mystique as a miracle worker. He would not have jetted off to the Middle East the end of last week unless he had been convinced that the objective conditions, a term he delights to use, were such that a ceasefire agreement between the parties was almost inevitable. After all, Egypt's Third Army was encircled, in effect encircled. Sadat needed desperately to show territory as proof that the October War had in fact been won in Arab terms. And Israel was staggering under the financial and manpower load of keeping an army at full readiness and full mobilization deep in the Sinai. And Israel, of course, was under terrific international pressure to show some willingness to bend and to be flexible, to make good on its promises, to be willing to meet with and adjust to Arab needs. And the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, Russia, obviously wanted to have the Suez Canal reopened in order that the small fleet which he has now introduced into the Persian Gulf and the Indian Ocean can be supplied by her own tankers and supply ships in order that she can become a major force in South Asia. And the United States obviously needed to prove to the Arab world that we were in fact living up to our announced policy of even-handedness, that we could be friends with the Arabs and prove our friendship even while we retained our sense of relationship with Israel. Washington was obviously eager to do something to make possible the reopening of the oil tap, and perhaps even more important, Washington was eager to have some credibility when the oil-consuming nations meet and Washington tries to organize the oil-consuming nations to prevent catastrophic further rises in the price of energy. Every party in these negotiations in short, had something to gain by this particular successful denouement. It was in the cards. And Secretary Kissinger is a man whom, as you know, turns up his cards, jets off to the Middle East, only when he knows that the game is won. What shall we say of the man? What kind of man is he? He's obviously become one of the fascinations of our country and of the world. His public life is well known. He's a man of 50. He was born in Bavaria, in Fürth, 50 years ago, of a German-Jewish family which delayed leaving Germany as long as it could. It was of those, I suspect, who could not believe that Hitler meant what he said. It wasn't until 1938 that the Kissingers came to New York, only after Kissinger Sr. had lost his job as a teacher in a German secondary school, and only after, and I think this was probably more important, their son, the apple of their eye, had been denied admission to a gymnasium and had been forced to attend an all-Jewish school. He was a brilliant boy. He graduated with a top record in New York City. And then, as is the way with so many immigrant young men, he had to support his family, so he worked by day and went to City College of New York by night to study to be an accountant. And I suspect he would have been a brilliant accountant indeed. But the war intervened, and Mr. Kissinger went into the service to be naturalized, to gain his citizenship. He was sent by the Army to the Army Specialized Training Program at Lafayette College, and this began to pull him out of his immigrant world, began to see something of America. And then he was shipped overseas, where he served in the counterintelligence as a German translator. And finally, he was assigned as a sergeant in our American military government to be the military governor of a small village not far from the town in which he had been raised. In 1946, after the war was over, he returned to Harvard University, where he enrolled at the age of 23 as a freshman, as one of those legion of returned veterans who brought a surprising degree of maturity, even to vaunted Harvard University. He studied by himself. He was then a loner. No one, quote unquote, seems to have known him. He did his work. He ground out some brilliant papers, and he graduated summa cum laude. And he proceeded to remain at Harvard in the Department of Government, and received from the university his PhD degree in the usual course of 4 years. While he was in the Department of Government, his major tutor and advisor was a man by the name of William Yandel Elliott, one of the classic teachers of Harvard, a man who had moved easily between Cambridge and Washington during the Hoover administration and during the Roosevelt administration, bringing the so-called expertise of theoretical international information and putting it to use through the Department of State as an advisor to senators, the Department of State, and presidents. And it was from Elliott, who was very much intoxicated in those years by the theories which the Germans had taught the world, the theories of realpolitik, the theory that you must understand the goals of your enemies, the political, the economic, the social goals, in order to be able to deal with them. The theory that you don't read their white papers, but you look at their actions and you look at their economy and you try to understand what it is that will give them security or give them prosperity. Elliott and others taught these theories to Kissinger, and he made them part of his life. And then, after some years, this young student, this man who believed in an objective interpretation of foreign policy, who did not believe in enthusiasms or moralisms, but in looking at armaments and looking at economy and economies and looking at the stated needs of the nation as the military of that nation expressed it, was invited by one of the great establishment groups in America, the Council of Foreign Affairs of New York City, to come down and to be the study director of a major project that they were undertaking, which had to do with the impact of nuclear weapons on our foreign policy. Mr. Kissinger spent 2 years in New York on this study, which was important not only in his own development, but because of the contacts that he made there. It had been largely financed by the Rockefeller Brothers Foundation, and it was chaired, as one might expect, by Nelson Rockefeller. And Nelson Rockefeller, even in those days, 1956, 57, had ambitions beyond that of New York City. And he was a man who knew how to draw on the expert knowledge, the long days with the books of younger men. And he befriended Mr. Kissinger, and he drew him into his circle. And 10 years later, in 1968, when Nelson Rockefeller made a run for the Republican nomination against Mr. Nixon, he asked Kissinger to come down from Harvard, in which Kissinger had now won a professorship in government, to be his foreign policy advisor during the campaign. And during that campaign, Kissinger wrote for Nelson Rockefeller a number of very trenchant political analyses. So trenchant that Nixon, Rockefeller's opponent, read them and was impressed by them. And at the end of the campaign, of the convention, when he had become the nominee of the party, he invited Nixon to come aboard his campaign. And when he won the election in November, he invited him to be his foreign policy advisor to the National Security Council. And from then on, the movement of Secretary Kissinger is history. Now, I suggested to you in the subject that I announced a relationship between Henry Kissinger and Niccolo Machiavelli. And I would like to suggest to you now that there are superficial analogies between their lives, and that there's a rather substantial intellectual analogy to be made. On a superficial level, both Machiavelli and Kissinger are men of medium height and dark hair. They are men whose fathers come from a line of middle class men and families of ability, who had lost their place in society and who therefore could not provide their sons the normal education available either in 16th century Florence or in 20th century Germany. Their sons learnt almost by themselves, on their own, at a slightly later date than they might have if they'd been exposed to the peer group and to the various school systems or tutoring systems of the day. Both men have made their way not by inherited wealth or inherited position, not because they have power or a power base in their own right, but by their wits and by their learning, because they were useful to someone who held office, who held power. And obviously, their authority depends entirely on the ability of that other person to remain in power. Both Machiavelli and Kissinger were men of immense ego, of immense self-assurance, of great learning, great ability, of retentive minds, and both men were also womanizers and libertines. But on a more substantial level, what impresses you as you relate these two figures is that both men look at life in an entirely unvarnished way. They see all the warts and all the ugliness and all the ambition and all the greed and all the hypocrisy of men. Machiavelli, you know, was the first to really set out an unvarnished doctrine of enlightened self-interest. He tried to teach his prince that you must never judge men by what they say, but only by what they do, and that the basic motives of men are vile and crass and greedy. And most men operate whatever they say by a logic of calculated self-interest. And Kitzinger, in a sense, is of the same bent of mind. I'm sure he spent very little time at Harvard or later reading the white papers by which governments justify their black deeds, reading the carefully edited lectures by heads of states in which they justify this takeover or that extension of their spheres of influence. What he read instead was the table of organization of their army. What he read instead was the writings of their economists as to exports and imports and needed natural resource. What he read instead were the action papers by which the academics of a particular country suggested to their diplomats what the country needed for prosperity, for security, to extend its borders and its influence. He's a man who assumes the worst of men and of nations, and so is Machiavelli. Kissinger is a man, for instance, who has no patience with the moralities with which most of us bandy about international headlines and affairs and by which we judge the actions of men. He says, for instance, again and again in his writings, that diplomacy does not seek peace, that diplomacy should not seek peace. Why not? Because there cannot be such a thing as peace in our world. Men and nations are always elbowing one another for Lebensraum, for living space, for greater markets, for greater spheres of influence, and that can only be done at somebody else's expense. In the world as the world is, there can never be a condition of peace. All that you can have is a temporary condition of relative stability. And so the goal of foreign policy must not be peace, because peace is beguiling but dangerous. Seeking peace, you are willing often to negotiate, and negotiation will only give an advantage to the man who recognizes that there cannot be peace. What you can have again and again in history for shorter periods of time is a condition of relative stability. When Canada and the United States are relatively prosperous and relatively comfortable and have sufficient sources of energy and have reasons to allow their individual citizens relatively free access to one another's markets, you have a temporary condition of peace. But when Canada has oil that the United States wants, or when Canada feels that American financial involvement in the control of Canadian businesses threatens the independence of Canadian foreign policy, you have a condition of tension. And if these tensions should become aggravated, you might have a condition of war. And so he is convinced that if diplomats, statesmen will only rid their eyes of moralisms, of the immemorial hopes of men, and seek talking about that which cannot be achieved, peace, and recognize that there must be scrambling and elbowing, international confrontation, that there will inevitably be wars and violence, because war is only diplomacy, greed being worked out at another level. The test of diplomacy becomes not whether you create stasis, whether you create peace, but whether or not you can limit war and limit violence to an acceptable level. Whether or not war will break out only when, in a sense, war inevitably must break out. And whether when it does break out, you can limit war within certain confines, rather than allowing it to be totally destructive. The study which he wrote for the Council of Foreign Affairs in 1956, which was published under the title Nuclear Weapons and Foreign Policy, is a fascinating document. It begins by an analysis of foreign policy under Presidents Eisenhower and Kennedy. And it suggests that, under President Eisenhower, I'm jumping my history here, and it suggests that President Eisenhower and his foreign policy advisors are misguided. Why? They are misguided because they assume that America can impose peace in the world because we have a tremendous nuclear deterrent. And we did. We had a nuclear arsenal second to none. At that stage, the Russian nuclear arsenal could not begin to rival ours. But he suggested that deterrence was effective only when a superpower was willing directly to confront another superpower, but that enlightened self-interest by Russia would make it very clear very quickly to the Russians that they could achieve many of their objectives without directly threatening the United States, without giving to the United States a cause sufficient to allow the United States to use its deterrent power. And that because we had invested all of our power in thermonuclear weapons, because we were repelled by the idea of a limited war, because we did not have flexible troops and rejected gunboat diplomacy, because we had refused to enter the nightmare world in which war is assumed, and the question is only how little can the war be maintained, be circumscribed, how narrowly can it be circumscribed. Because we had not done this, we were in fact among the most impotent of major powers. We could prevent a major confrontation, but we could not prevent the continued domination of Eastern Europe by the Soviet. We could not prevent the economic and military interpenetration by the Soviet of the Middle East, because they fought through volunteers, they fought through second and third parties, other parties. They did not give us a casus belli, a chance for brinkmanship. And lacking flexibility, lacking the capacity for limited war, unwilling even to conceive of a limited war which might use nuclear warheads, which incidentally Secretary Kissinger was then in favor of, if it needed to be, the United States, in a sense, presented itself to the Soviet Union as a power which had to deal and negotiate from weakness rather than from strength. What you need to do, in Secretary Kissinger's mind, is always to keep pushing at the enemy in order to allow him to push back, and out of this push and shove, you sometimes get a condition of temporary stability. But if you try to negotiate, if you are honest in your search for peace, other nations of the world will always be taking advantage of you. In his writings, Secretary Kissinger always makes a differentiation between what he calls legitimate powers and revolutionary powers. Now, these are not moral terms. A legitimate power is simply a power which admits the basic legitimacy of the other nations which are part of its world. The United States in relation to Canada is a relationship of legitimacy. We accept the sovereignty of Canada. Canada essentially accepts our sovereignty. We have issues between us, but these issues can be negotiated, and the wars, the tensions will always be limited between two powers which accept their legitimacy. But there are also revolutionary powers in the world. These are powers who refuse to deal with some other government or governments because of their form of government, because of their basic philosophy, or because of the megalomania of the leaders of a particular country. In his PhD thesis, in which he dealt with Europe at the beginning of the 19th century, he wrote on Mr. Castlereagh, who was the Prime Minister of England, and Prince Metternich, who was the Prime Minister of Austria, and the relationships which led up to the Congress of Vienna and afterwards. In this thesis, he used Napoleon and France as the example of a revolutionary party. And his example is interesting. After Napoleon's defeat in Russia, the Allied powers, Russia, Austria, England, Germany, Prussia, offered a peace to Napoleon which should have given Napoleon greater power, greater freedom of operation, and larger boundaries for France than France had ever had in the past century. Napoleon rejected that peace, as Metternich had known he would, because he was not only the leader of France, but he had a megalomania to conquer the world, and he was leader of a revolutionary France whose ideas of citizenship were so antithetical to the old feudal ideas which governed Austria and Russia, which he felt had to be overthrown. Hitler's Germany represents a revolutionary power. And interestingly, the Soviet Union, throughout Kissinger's writings, represents a revolutionary power. A power which will not admit the legitimacy of other governments, and therefore cannot ever arrive at a relationship of stability with those governments, because a revolutionary power must either impose its will totally on its world or be destroyed or change its nature. But as long as it seeks total security, which it must have because it always fears subversion, you cannot have arrangements. You cannot negotiate. You cannot have this condition of stability. Throughout the 50s and 60s, Kissinger wrote vividly, intelligently, acidly of the actions of the Soviet Union. And it's certainly this that endeared him to Nelson Rockefeller and endeared him to President Nixon. And he tried to make clear to America, at least to those who govern foreign political decisions in America, just why it was that Russia could not be trusted to negotiate. He said again and again, you know, one of the problems with American foreign policy is it's run essentially by lawyers and by businessmen, by good men, who are used to Yankee trading, to doing all that they can in a confrontation, in a business relationship, in a legal battle, to gain their advantage. But that once the contract is signed, once a decision is rendered, they accept it. And so Americans enter negotiations with an assumption of their basic validity, that they will conclude something, that you move on to a new issue. The Soviet Union, any revolutionary power, Kissinger has said again and again, enters negotiation with an entirely different point of view. Negotiations to them are not to conclude, but simply to gain advantage or to gain a breathing spell. They are tactical. They do not look upon negotiations as a way of bringing peace, but simply as a way of gaining their point or gaining time. Those who negotiate with a revolutionary power, he says, always find themselves at Munich. It's rather paradoxical that this is the man who has sponsored the idea of détente with the Soviet Union. Mr. Kissinger is a man of action. Because he believes that there's always elbowing and pressuring and pushing and shoving going on in the international world, he's a man who believes that American foreign policy must be active. We must push and we must shove even as we negotiate. Zhou Enlai, when he was in Peking, paid him this compliment. He said, Mr. Kissinger, you have a Chinese mind. And indeed, we're seeing the paradoxes that we see reflect this kind of mind. A mind which pushes for stability, often by doing what we from our perspective, our moralistic perspective, find to be unacceptable. You make peace in Southeast Asia by invading Cambodia. Why? How? Because your invasion of Cambodia becomes a signal to Hanoi that you will use power, that you are not powerless, that if they want temporary stability, they must respond from power. Negotiate from power. Negotiate from activity. I read in the paper this morning that the United States was moving towards developing a new form of nuclear warhead on the top of a new kind of ballistic missile delivery system. This is precisely the kind of activity that Secretary Kissinger initiates before he returns to Geneva or to Vienna for another round on the international control of weapons and of missiles. You threaten, you act, you force then another nation to react. Your position is never a moral one. It's always one which uses such power as you possess in order to make it clear to whoever you are dealing with it that you possess power and that you're free to use it. For power is useless if it's always held in reserve. Mr. Kissinger, in other words, has very little use for peaceniks and pacifists, for moralists, or for moral reasons for doing things. And he's not an immoral or amoral man. Indeed, all of us must be careful to recognize that what he has done is simply to expose for us the absolute jungle condition in which governments conduct their business with other governments. In much of his writing, Kissinger tries to make a sharp differentiation between bureaucrats and government officials as they must deal with domestic policy and bureaucrats and government officials as they must deal with foreign policy. He says when it comes to domestic policy, you derive a national consensus, there's a will, and then everybody sets to make a particular welfare program or social justice program operate. In foreign affairs, there's no consensus. There's only greed. There's only motion. There's no law. There's no way of changing policy because there is no policy, only the separate ambitions of the separate states. And unless one recognizes the existence of this jungle, unless one is a bastard among fellow bastards, one cannot achieve any chance of stability, any chance of arrangement. And before we dam out of hand the invasion of Cambodia, the United States is out of Vietnam. And before we dam the expenditure of more billions of dollars for international missile for intercontinental ballistic missile, we do have a first round agreement in the SALT talks. There's great danger in this. There's danger that the process itself, because Kissinger's always interested in action, in process, rather than in goal and objective, that the process consumes you, that power runs away with itself, that as you push yourself into a position where another country will respond and you get that kind of escalation which leads to a war which nobody wants. But it's a statement of the condition of the world. And we live in a cruel world. And we cannot live in this world as if it were other than in fact it is. Now is Secretary Kissinger good for the Jews? I think among Jews, that's the question I most often hear and am most often asked. Is it good for Israel? Secretary Kissinger is a Jew. How good a Jew he is, I don't know. I doubt that he's been in a synagogue since he left Germany. I doubt that his being a Jew affects in any positive way his relationships with Israel. If anything, his being a Jew may be a negative. You may have seen the little byplay this week in which when During one of these trips, Kissinger returned to Jerusalem. He made quite a to-do of the fact that the Israelis were rather cool, they didn't kiss him on all cheeks, and that the Arabs had done so. Now, if you know German Jews, they're disciplined, they're intellectually aware, they're sensitive. The last thing they like is anybody slobbering over them. They're not effusive people in that sense. And Mr. Kissinger is a man who never says anything that he doesn't mean to say. What was he saying? He wasn't saying he wanted Moshe Dayan to kiss him on both cheeks. What he was saying to the Arab world was, look, when I'm among my own, I'm no closer to them than I am to you. In fact, I let you handle me in a way I don't allow them to handle me. He needs talking points with the Arab world. He needs to show them that his being a Jew doesn't count for much. What counts is his position as Secretary of State and advisor to the President. And in that sense, and to that degree, his being a Jew may be for Israel something of a drawback. He may try to bend over backwards, not to react as we might want any Jew or expect any Jew to react. But I think the most important fact is that he doesn't serve a Jewish master. He serves President Nixon. He's a black man. He's not his own man. He ultimately must do what somebody else directs him to do. And the test really is not, is he good for Israel or is he not good for Israel, but what are Mr. Nixon and this administration's plans for the Middle East? What do they need? And here the issue is obviously is complicated. There's a record of support. There's a record of the sending of arms both before the October War and replenishments during the October War. But there are also very clear indications now that Mr. Nixon needs a number of foreign policy victories in order to shore up his position post-Watergate back home. Now it's relatively clear that the one golden, if it be golden, spot or record that Nixon can show is in foreign policy. He opened the doors to China. He has a detente with Russia. He will bring some kind of peace to the Middle East, which means not peace necessarily for the Middle East, but the opening of the oil tap, which means that he's handled Saudi Arabia, and Americans can drive their cars as often, as fast, as far as they may wish. If that be the scenario which preoccupies Mr. Nixon's mind, then Mr. Kissinger must gain these objectives, and obviously they can be gained to a large degree only at the expense of Israel. But it's not a clear picture. He's a man of action, and the Middle East needed movement. What was could not be maintained. Either the lines of 67 or these lines partially in Egypt, partially in the Sinai after 67. Israel herself has said constantly, 67, we are willing to negotiate territory for recognition, for stable boundaries. A man of action can sometimes stimulate reaction, movement. They are sitting down, Egypt and Israel, at Geneva. There is this pullback. There may be the opportunity for other more consequential, more difficult arrangements. I don't know. But using Mr. Kissinger's own analysis, the situation is a difficult one for Israel. For therefore, the United States, the Arab states, are legitimate governments. That is, they admit the existence of the United States and we can live with them. For the Arab states, Israel is not a legitimate government. That is, for Israel, the Arab states are revolutionary. And therefore, by Kissinger's own traditional analysis, negotiations between a legitimatized government and revolutionary governments lead to Munich are impossible because they never quite mean what they say. When President Sadat went yesterday to Damascus, I assure you that what he told the leaders of Damascus was not that we are working out peace with Israel, but they are working out phase one of the weakening of Israel, which can be followed by phase two after we get Israel back to the 67 borders and will be worked out under the phase of returning the Palestinians to Israel, regaining for them their, quote, legitimate rights, end of quote. A more important question, in a sense, is Kissinger good for the United States? Is it good for us? And again, the question is hard to answer. His inventive mind is towards realpolitik, towards the military, towards push and to shove. He's a leader of a country which wants desperately not to think nightmare thoughts, not to look at the world as it really is. Since the middle 1960s, when Vietnam suddenly crushed down on us, neo-isolationism has been the basic mood in these United States. We don't want to think about the rest of the world. We want to get on with the business of solving our own very real communal, urban, social, racial poverty problems. We want to pull our troops out of Europe. We don't want to be involved in any other foreign wars. Mr. Kissinger is the Secretary of State of a country which is finding it difficult to look at itself still as a major world power. In that sense, in the sense that he may try to find ways of exhibiting our power, he may delay China or Russia or the Third World or France from moving into areas which they might better not move into. But there's a paradox here, and it's the paradox of his master. Again, for domestic reasons, Mr. Nixon must play to the mood of America. I doubt that in his heart of hearts, Secretary Kissinger believes that there is a detente with the Soviet Union. It'd be almost incredible for a man who's that aware of the affairs of the world for him to be able to believe it. In no other period, no other 18 months since the end of the Second World War, have Russian arms and Russian power moved as far and as fast. The interpenetration in the Middle East, naval units into the Persian Gulf. They've been able to show Western Europe that they cannot maintain their unity if the oil tap is shut off. You may have seen 2 weeks ago in the papers that the Russians are now flying out of Conakry on the west coast of Africa, flying boats which cover the entire South Atlantic. There is now a mutual aid treaty between India and the Soviet Union. Iraq and Syria are almost entirely Soviet satellites. Russia has been able to move far the last 18 months or 2 years, as America has withdrawn and buried its head and salved its Vietnam wounds. And Marshal Gretschko, who seems to be within the Soviet, the great expounder of Soviet ambition, just last week announced again that this was the time for the Soviet Union to maintain its readiness, to maintain its thrust and its élan. Things were going its way. But for various reasons, Mr. Nixon needs detente. He needs Americans to feel that his visit to China was not opening the doors to, was an opening of the doors to peace, and not simply a way of trying to bring pressure on the Soviet Union by giving added authority to the Soviet Union's number one enemy. He needs to make Americans feel that the relationship between Brezhnev and Nixon is not simply a relationship born out of Russia's concern with the emerging American-Chinese relationship, but is detente, is a genuine concern by both powers for peace, for stability in our world. He needs constantly to mask what he does. And that was never more clearly in evidence than during the first week of the Egyptian-Syrian-Israel conflict, when he could not bring himself to say what was in fact a fact, that the Soviet Union had catalyzed this war, in a sense initiated the war, was using the war for its own geopolitical Near Eastern ambitions and plans, that the war had in every sense violated the spirit of détente. It was only at the very end of the conflict, when the Soviet Union had to clearly show its hand by threatening armed intervention if Israel weren't to encircle the entire Third Army, that the United States said no. And even then, even during that period of nuclear confrontation, when our troops were on a worldwide alert, no one said that the détente is broken. Kissinger said only that the détente cannot long survive this kind of action. Niccolo Machiavelli served his Florentine masters as emissary, secretary of state, with mind, skill, and ability for 25 years. And then the Signory of Florence were overthrown by the armies of one of the Borgias, and Machiavelli was exiled to the countryside. It's there he read the books that so many of us were subjected to, The Prince and others, while we were in college. What's Mr. Kissinger's future? Well, Mr. Nixon has a limited stay in office, 3 years, 3 months, 3 days, who knows? If Mr. Rockefeller is his successor, Mr. Kissinger may have a longer run for his money. He's certainly the one man in Washington who can show accomplishment. Whatever he does has consequences. Believe it or not, this man, this Machiavelli, has won a Nobel Peace Prize. But at some point, there'll be a new or a different administration. And then the Machiavellis of the world are put out to pasture, are sent back to Harvard University. And I suspect at that time we will find ourselves regaled by a number of very interesting books, by a man who writes heavily but thoughtfully, incisively, and that any of us who are concerned with what the world is really like had better read those books. Because whatever he is or he is not, just as whatever Machiavelli was or Machiavelli was not, these are men who, because they know themselves, know the world. They're cold-minded men, and we live in a cold world. And anyone who wants to survive in this world had better beware. Had better recognize that small powers, small ambitions, self-delusion are suicidal. Could Mr. Kissinger see the destruction of Israel? Yes. As an historian, he knows that the blacks, Christians of the Sudan are being systematically destroyed. He knows that Czechoslovakia could not win back his freedom. He knows that the Armenians have in effect been persecuted out of significant existence. It might give him pause for a night or be a paragraph in a book. But he recognizes that in the real world, size counts and power counts and oil counts and courage counts and will is of importance. He can tolerate the thought. He may not like it. But he would say to us, I suspect, and with this I close, the world holds no guarantees for anyone. Israel may disappear, Soviet Union may disappear, the United States will ultimately disappear as the forms in which all these countries are now. And the question ultimately is one of leadership, the ego. Machiavelli, Kissinger, these men are men of tremendous ego. Test of a nation is a test of will. The test of a leader is the ability to use the power, the will, the spirit of a nation to the nation's advantage. The test of Israel's survival will be the capacity of its leaders to use whatever opportunities are theirs to their advantage. Will they? Will they not? We'll suffer, and we'll struggle, and we'll give, and we'll fight. Mr. Kissinger will write the books. Amen.